investigate and prosecute genocidal incitement. Nothing. This is the first settler colonial genocide to ever appear before an international tribunal. And I truly hope that an opportunity to deliver justice to the Palestinians, and in a contorted way to the Israelis as well, will not be missed. Because only by restoring justice there is an opportunity that peace will be brought to that land, and somewhat it will be a recognition that justice is possible also for other indigenous people. Thank you.
You're listening to Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Can you speak to the role of media, especially in countries that are supporting the genocide, ethnic cleansing, whatever the legal term is, agreed, and how sort of this domination of the narrative of what's happening is actually helping bring the public opinion support for sort of this cycle of the violence and the support, especially the United States? We know they're funding, supporting, arming, providing diplomatic cover for the attacks, and then also government officials attacking you as a UN official. Thanks.
The role of the media, where to start? Look, I think that this is not new in the sense, if you look at the acts of the criminal proceedings, both in Rwanda and in former Yugoslavia, you will find that the media often play a critical role in genocides, in the sense it amplifies it takes sides. The mainstream media tends to be complacent with the ruling power and become a tool in the hands of the genocidaire. What is really critical here and absolutely shocking is that this is not Israeli media. Actually, we owe much of what we know, for example, on some of the crimes that have been committed to courageous Israeli journalists. And there are many Israelis, not as many as they should, and as many as we need, but it will change. There are many Israelis who oppose this system, oppose what Israel has been doing as of October 7, and without denying what Israelis have suffered on October 7. But again, they can avoid the contextualization. So what I've seen the media doing is replicating, giving a platform to the Israeli army, as it was, again, doing, it's what I've called the humanitarian camouflage, justifying the violation of international law, the violation of the principle of distinctions, of proportionality, of military necessity. And again, the Palestinian population has become a population of human shields. But in fact, the human shields that we have seen evidence of were used by the Israeli army. And how do we know that? Thanks to the Israeli media. And again, also the media, but also some politicians, including in these countries, have talked about the beheaded babies. There were no beheaded babies, which doesn't take anything away from the crimes that have been committed on October 7. But why this fascination and this toxic propension to magnify brutality and mass rapes? There were no mass rapes. I mean, there was no evidence of mass rapes. There is a commission of inquiry which was investigated. We cannot discard that there might have been incidents of rapes, but why? We don't know. But there is clearly no evidence of mass rapes. So the question is, why there is no outrage for what Israeli human rights organizations have reported being networks of torture across Israeli detention centers post-October 7. And this was not, Palestinians have been systematically abused, often tortured. We know that through Israeli organizations mostly, because the Palestinians were not allowed to get into Israeli prisons. But, and also some Western correspondents, I think it was CNN, who entered or accessed some of the witnesses. So, and again, there's, it's, if I had to be very blunt and brutal, I think that our societies have a huge problem with racism that can decline in different forms. Clearly, we have not dealt with real antisemitism. I hear that. I hear that. It exists. And it's repulsive and it's disgusting. And I say that especially among Western fellows and especially among European fellows, this is something that shall not, should not, must not come back ever because of the history that we have inflicted on this people. At the same time, critiquing the state of Israel is not anti-Semitic. So we should not conflate the two things. There is also another problem that is evident is the fact that there has been an increasing level of racism against Palestinians. Anti-Palestinian racism goes completely undetected. If half of the things that are said about the Palestinians were said about the Israelis, and most people will be in jail. And the thing is that we need to treat individuals equally as human beings. We cannot be sensitive on language toward one group while being totally abusive toward another. So the media will be dealt with one day, I hope. But we have to be the guardians of some basic principles, because it seems that, I mean, again, I encourage everyone to read Primo Levi, who's a Holocaust survivor from my own country, Italy. And he has written memorable, very accessible, fundamental pages that show the risk of return of fascism when the reason gets on as a sort of when dozes off on a sleeping mode.
Thank you. I'd like to hear your response to the Israeli objection to your suggestion that withdrawal from the occupied territories would solve the problem. They would say, we did withdraw from Gaza, and look what happened on October 7th.
The withdrawal from Gaza, what happened in 2005 is that the state of Israel, under the leadership of Ariel Sharon, withdrew the colonies, dismantled the colonies in Gaza, something that has had a huge impact on the radicalization of the settler movement. And again, this there is a lot written by Israeli scholars, scholar Nurit Peled, on this. But the colonies are evidence of colonization, not of military occupation. The military occupation exists when there is effective control of the territory, which in fact remain. Because after 2005, not only Israel has maintained maritime access through sea, land and air over Gaza on all borders. It has sealed all borders. It has continued to control the currency, the civil record registry, the telecommunication space, the natural resources. I mean, have you seen how easy it has been for the Palestinians in Gaza to starve after October 9? Because Israel controlled and could turn off water, electricity, and provision of fuel and other means. Plus, one of the two critical elements are that Israel has controlled the caloric intake that an average Gaza was allowed to have. Well, I mean, in Gaza, there were also wealthy people before October 7. So but the majority of the people were living on hands out provided by humanitarian organizations. And because of the violence and the war, 90% of the children before October 7 displayed depression-like syndromes. Let's not even go into what their parents were experiencing. The other critical element is that after 2005, Israel retained unilaterally the right to carry out preventive strikes, meaning to what the Israeli army used to refer to, let's say, an awful expression, to mon de lon, to attack Gaza. Of course, it was a ghetto. It was a ghetto where and people had no freedom and the violence was extreme. And plus, Hamas, he was born under, also with the support of Israel, to break the secular leadership of Palestine. He was born like a welfare organization, and then he became a political party in response to the Oslo Accords. There is no question that Hamas has committed orchestrated crimes against the Israelis. But Hamas would have not become the force it has had not there been that level of oppression and the occupation. Because I was in Gaza and others have documented it. There were several attempts from the people in Gaza to overthrow Hamas, whose first victims in Gaza were the Palestinians. All those after they won the election and then they were rejected by the international community, there was an internal fight that lasted almost 2 years. And many Palestinians affiliated with the PA, the Fatah, the main opponent, were killed. And so the system pre-October 7 was very convenient to the Israeli government, which has often referred Netanyahu first and foremost, but also other members of his current cabinet, to Hamas as an asset and the Palestinian Authority as a liability. Again, I take your question as referred to by the Israelis, meaning if we withdraw from Gaza, we will have another October 7. This is a very racist thought. And we should really question this kind of thought, meaning the people, if they are let free, they will turn into barbarians. It's like opening the cage. What is it? It's not that the Palestinians are naturally prone to violence. They want to live a normal life like anyone else and don't believe the monstrosities that are told, because they were not true. They are not true about the Palestinians today as much as they were not true about the Jewish people in Europe 80, 90 years ago. Because if you read the acts of proceedings from the Nuremberg and also the Nuremberg trials, you will see that Jewish children were reportedly killed because they were seen as a security threat. So we need to know the past in order to prevent it from returning.
What would an investigation into genocide look like? Who would take the lead? How would Palestinians be involved? How would Israelis be involved? How would the West be involved? Who would try these people? How would we investigate? Where would they be tried? Where would they be held? Just how would an investigation and justice, what would it look like?
I cannot tell you. I don't want to speculate. I cannot tell you. I cannot elaborate much because I've not been thinking of that. But first of all, this is something that is not different from what has been done with other crimes, war crimes and crimes against humanity. You look at the facts. You look at the facts objectively. You collect the evidence, and then you analyze it against international standards. There is, not extensive jurisprudence on genocide, but there is. And it's very telling. I've tried in this last report to give a sense of what is genocidal intent attributable to a state. And so much can be derived and drawn from that jurisprudence. But there are two things that I'm compelled to say, is that there are two types of investigations. And the threshold for the evidentiary threshold cannot be the same. Because first, there is criminal responsibility of individuals, and the genocide there or alleged perpetrators of genocide can be tried by the International Court of the International Criminal Court, but also other tribunals, because state parties to the Genocide Convention have an obligation to prevent and prosecute and punish the crime of genocide. And so this can be activated. Investigations can be also launched by by domestic courts. And then there is the responsibility of the state that can only be investigated by the International Court of Justice. But again, if we used the evidentiary standards set to ensure fair trial to alleged perpetrators, we would never, and we need to wait for that trial to be over, assuming that one prosecutor initiates such a trial, then there would be impossibility to prevent genocide. The responsibility to prevent genocide arises the moment the risk is there. And that risk was identified on January 26. As of then, the responsibility kicks in, including for states who had the obligation, the legal obligation, not as an act of charity, not to aid and assist a state who could be plausibly commit acts of genocide. And this is why I really hope that this country, with a wonderful lawyers say it has will look into these and try to contribute to the advancement of justice.
Since Palestine is not a state in the UN system, how is it able to access laws and resources? And I would add the courts that you were just talking about. So as a non-state actor, what kind of rights do they have?
This is not accurate because it's not true that the state of Palestine is not a state. Under the Montevideo Convention, which is customarily looked at like the criteria to recognize the existence of a state, recognition by other states is not a founding criterion to have a state. A state exists when there is a government over a territory, over a people, which has the capacity to establish contact with the international community. And I think there are 136 states recognizing, more or less, don't take me for granted, I mean, to be checked, who recognize the state of Palestine, which is also a member with observer status at the UN. So it has accessed the main treaties. It has an authority, the Palestinian Authority. The point is that it's a state born in captivity in 1988. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was the government in exile of the Palestinian people, voted for the establishment of a state in whatever territory remained, meaning in the 1967 occupied territory. So in 1974, they had renounced the liberation struggle, the idea of taking the land back from the settlers. And in 1974, they formulated a one state proposal. They said, we can live together, but the refugees need to be allowed to be back. And it was, you know, of course, it never materialized. But even after the Oslo Accords, what should have become the full and sovereign independent state of Palestine has not materialized because the Oslo Accords were never intended to grant independence and sovereignty to the Palestinians. They were an interim step to consolidate control Israeli control over Palestinian land. And so the Oslo Accords have not been a failure for the Israelis. They've been successful, I mean, in further dispossessing the Palestinians. And this is not the first case, because even in this country, I mean, I was reading a book some time ago about how the Native American rights were violated despite treaties signed with them. So there is some precedent to the Oslo Accords. So Palestine, even if it's not fully sovereign and it's considered a state, the point is where it's very hypocritical to be a broker to the two-state solution and not even recognize the state and vote against the state of Palestine, the recognition of the state of Palestine inside the UN. So I said, and the court has confirmed this, enough with the two-state mantra, if it's not premised upon the right of self-determination of the Palestinians, which again means the right to be free, either in the form of a state or with full citizenship rights without discrimination. It must be either or.
How do you explain the lack of action on the Security Council or the UN? And it seems like they're like paralyzed. Whatever decisions they make or agree on is just discarded by the Zionist state of Israel.
Well, the UN, we shouldn't dream. The UN is a reflection of the world order. And this world order was designed and devised in the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. It has evolved from a group of states which were fundamentally colonial powers and some other states which are gaining independence by then. But the majority of the member states who compose today the General Assembly gained independence from the colonial system after the 60s and 70s and through the 80s, and some even after that. So some states are even decolonized, I mean, have decolonized themselves very, very recently. So the system is not equal. The voting patterns in the UN Security Council reflect that, the fact that there are some states with veto power. And there is no question that there is a clear imbalance and in favor of Western countries. As a Western person, I feel really disappointed because we had, as Western countries, we had the opportunity to really be a model in many ways because of the development we had reached decades ago before it turned into extremely destructive and greedy. And we could have used our soft power, but recognizing the injustices of the past, we should have really atoned for what we have done through slavery, through colonialism and other forms of oppression of native people. We cannot continue without booking our colonial and doing our colonial amnesia. Therefore, I think that nowadays it's facing a critical challenge, and in my collapse, in its entirety, and I fear that, because we will miss human rights when we don't have them anymore. We will miss the UN when we won't have it anymore. And the order that might come next, I don't take it for granted that it will be a better system. Again, I really saw the potential and the value of having political system premised upon freedoms, freedom of expression, freedom of association, and fundamental civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights. This is the challenge that we have completely missed. This is where we have failed as international, as Western countries, Western societies, and we can still come back. We are suspended, I often say, between the precipice, the abyss, and hope. Hope comes from the Palestinians and the Israelis who resist and can imagine a decolonized future, and from the youth. Frankly, I really praise the many of you who have shown older people what it means to walk the talk when it comes to human rights. So thank you. Thank you very much. And also thank you to the scholars and the faculty members who stood in solidarity, but not in solidarity, with a sense of responsibility with you. Because this is what conscientious people do. And we need to continue. I know that I could hear the strong emotions in the young lady who asked this question. I've realized how these moments, these conferences, even international law lectures, turn into a moment of collective grief. Because there is no other space in our societies to elaborate that grief. We need to accept that some of us deal with it by hiding themselves in denial, others feel enraged. But let's turn this feeling into something useful. And there are actions that can be taken to stop the system. You have already started. This country, and especially I was so impressed with what young Jewish Americans have done since October last year. I was here. I used to live here 10 years ago. So I was very familiar with the wonderful work of organizations like Jewish Voices for Peace. But still, as of October last year, I saw a new generation, and it's impressive. So join forces with those who are already working in this to change the system. Challenge your political representatives and also challenge the media. And this, in this country, the boycott, divest, and sanction movement it's almost, in some states, it's criminalized. This is not normal. The BDS is an act of protest. It's premised upon international law emanating from an ICJ advisory opinion. And this is what has led to the end, I mean, has contributed to lead to the end of apartheid in South Africa. Why it cannot be applied here? And even now, there are Israeli citizens asking for international pressure to lead to sanction. And I think that this is it.
You were just listening to Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza. She spoke at Georgetown University at the end of October. Francesca Albanese is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Naomi Klein, Ilan Pape, Norman Finkelstein, Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza, and for the classic Edward Said book, Culture and Resistance, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Be me. Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
Broadcast